give us a sense of what was going on around the campus in Oxford in April of 1970.
Let me begin by commenting a bit on the character of student culture in the late 1960s, specifically at Miami. Like the rest of the country, Miami was experiencing a clash of generations between the sort of World War II generation who were in charge of the university and students who were quite restless about in loco parentis of various kinds. In loco parentis meaning the discipline that was expected for students to follow in both their curriculum and in their life outside the classroom. Well, there were a number of protest movements emerging, among them black students who formed the Black Student Action Association in 1968, advocating hiring more black faculty, teaching black studies, recruiting black students. The Associated Women students got active in early versions of feminism. They brought Kate Millett, the author of Sexual Politics, to campus in 1970. There was a 24-hour visitation campaign to try to create full male and female visitation policies for the campus residence halls. And among the faculty, there was a generation younger than the World War II generation that had matured into the faculty, but they were more liberal, and they were calling for various kinds of curriculum reform. And one group called the New University Conference led that charge. And among their claims was that there was a moral obligation for the university to not have ROTC on campus. Of course, that created a backlash among faculty as well as disputes among students. But as early as 1968, there was concern about the Vietnam War. There had been a symposium sponsored by the student government in 1968 that brought both pro and con speakers from all over the country and the world, actually, to debate that question. So the Vietnam War was a central issue. And that was appealing to students because in the late 1960s and certainly in 1970, male students were subject to the draft. And they were quite concerned about that. So that gives you a sense of a sort of contentious environment in the run-up to events at Rowan Hall.
Then what happened on April 15th, 1970?
Well, the objections to the war in Vietnam had flowered in several different ways. There was an effort by 2,000 students to march on Lewis Place as early as 1969, supporting a national Vietnam moratorium in Washington. They wanted classes to be canceled. That failed. There was a mock ROTC drill team that followed the ROTC drilling students around with sticks and umbrellas, and they were closely observed by authorities. The situation was that different communities in the student community, like women, men, conservatives, liberals, independents, and fraternities, were coming together around opposition to the draft and, by extension, opposition to the war. Social fraternities had published their support in the newspaper for the March on Washington. So what happened on April 15th was students had a big protest on the lawn of the administration building, Rodebush Hall, objecting in particular to the presence of Dow Chemical Company recruiting on campus. Dow made napalm. At the end of that rally, one enterprising young man said, "We're just talking and talking, we're not doing anything." And he led a group over, and they broke into the door of the ROTC building, Rowan Hall, went inside, sat down, ordered pizza, and a band came in, and they started talking about their objections to ROTC on campus and to the Vietnam War and to university policies. Well, Miami administrators reacted at first, in their view at least, rather gently. They came over and read regulations, student conduct regulations, saying that if people didn't get up and leave, they would be arrested and or suspended, summarily suspended from the university and arrested. They went away. Some students did leave, but others stayed. They came back again, read a second such statement, and then pronounced that the students were suspended. The Ohio Highway Patrol had been called, and they came in and arrested 176 students. Well, that actually was going along reasonably smoothly as protest situations in those days went, until some people outside the building who were watching the circumstances got agitated by what was going on. And here the evidence gets a little bit murky, but we know there were 17 different law enforcement agencies on campus. They were uncoordinated, not at all with the kind of communication that people that law enforcement has today. Plus the Butler County Sheriff's Office. Some of them, probably the Butler County Sheriff, had brought tear gas and police dogs. And there was some kind of confrontation. This is disputed, but many say that some rocks were thrown at police cars and maybe a window was broken. And then the tear gas started. And confrontations then sort of spread across campus all the way into uptown. There was a police dog that charged into a fraternity house uptown and bit a student. And so it was just a really messy situation where things got out of control. The next day, well, actually on April 20th, that the Miami student newspaper plus faculty groups began distributing leaflets and printing stories calling for a general strike of classes at camp on campus. And that strike was observed by a number of people who met outside in an alternative university. The things were going along pretty peacefully until April 21st, when there was a flush-in, it was called, where students emptied the water tower of the town by opening faucets and flushing toilets in the residence halls. And that really irritated people in the city of Oxford, or the town of Oxford. Authorities feared for fire protection, water backed up in the basements of the people who lived in the town. And that sort of turned public sentiment against the students in a way that had not been true prior to the flush-in. The Senate president officially apologized, but, you know, the cat was out of the bag. And so those were the events that happened immediately.
And then the governor, at the time, Governor Rhodes, he sent in some soldiers, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Governor Rhodes had deployed a battalion of 700 soldiers, National Guard soldiers, to Oxford after the April 15th event. They stayed on a Nike base, which was located just outside of town. They never came on campus. Dr. Shriver, the president at the time, knew Governor Rhodes well, and Governor Rhodes came down here. They had a big meeting in Rodebush Hall and talked about how the state wanted to help keep law and order. That was how Governor Rhodes put it, if necessary. But Dr. Shriver said he didn't think that was necessary. And so the National Guard never came on campus here. In similar events at Kent State, on May 5th, shortly thereafter, the Guard did go on campus. And as we know, that resulted in the killing of four students. At that point, Dr. Shriver, fearing violence on the Miami campus, like many other presidents in many other campuses, he sent all the students home and closed the university temporarily. So those were the immediate aftermath events of the Rouen Hall occupation.
And what do you see now as some of, if there are any, lasting changes that came from that demonstration?
Well, in my view, this was a major turning point toward the university that we have today. And here's the way I want to put that. There have been student revolts from time to time. There was one in the 1840s that against faculty authority that resulted in the formal acceptance of fraternal organizations, social fraternities. This one was a more prominent one in our time that objected to how the university conducted itself when students had concerns about what was going on nationally and on campus. Dr. Shriver, to his credit, stayed on campus during the time the campus was closed, and a group of student leaders also stayed on campus, and they negotiated with Dr. Shriver for better relations following the reopening. The university reopened after 10 days, and soon thereafter, began to be changes. Governance approved such things as credit, no credit options for students. They admitted students to governing bodies. They finally passed residence hall visitation. But beyond that, President Shriver brought in a 37-year-old provost who came in July of 1970, and he initiated widespread reform in the university's curriculum and some of its other practices as well. The Institute for Environmental Science, which had formed among science departments in 1969, actually moved into the Nike missile base when it was closed. Brown supported creating a residential college on the Western College for Women campus after the merger in 1974. And that school within the university adopted an experimental college motif with active learning, experimentation, and pedagogy of various kinds. It lasted until 2006 and was really a place to practice innovation at Miami University and influence the larger campus. And so what came out of that included such things as the Lilly Teaching Scholars in 1979, another project championed by David Brown that involved working with faculty and new kinds of active learning pedagogy and one-on-one work with students. The Miami Plan for Liberal Education project, which came along in the 1980s, owed a great deal of its impetus to the active learning pedagogy that had emerged following the aftermath of Rouen Hall. And today it's cited often as a model program for general education at universities. And then in 1985, Richard Mole came along and called Miami one of the public ivies, that is, high-quality education at a reasonable cost. And that book put a name on the changes that had occurred in the aftermath of Rouen Hall in curriculum and interaction with students, and positioned the university pretty well in the 20th century education marketplace. So I think that that we should think of the Rouen Hall events of April 15th as a tipping point in a long series of events that led to the kind of university we have today.
And how, if at all, do you think it changed Oxford, you know, outside of the university?
Well, the town of Oxford in this era was undergoing significant changes. In the 1960s and in the early 1970s, most of the faculty who taught at Miami lived very close to the university in residential areas. That has changed because suburban housing has grown up around the town of Oxford and people have moved out, but also better transportation has allowed people to live away from Oxford and still work here. So those kinds of changes had dramatic effects. The university continued to grow, and much of the housing in Oxford has turned to student housing instead of residential property, rental housing. And and response to that, Uptown, as it's called, has evolved into Uptown has evolved into businesses that cater to student needs. So now there's lots of restaurants and drinking establishments and sub shops and the like. And in more recent years, the Uptown has been physically restructured so that new buildings or renovations of older buildings have created places for students to live above and businesses to serve them below. Now, you might say that's unrelated to Rowan Hall, but the kinds of liberalizing tendencies that occurred at the end of In Loco Parentis and the university feeling that it should control all aspects of student life, both outside as well as inside the classroom, the loosening of those strictures contributed to the evolution of the town into really a student community that's broader than the campus alone. And I think that's a consequence of a parallel movement to what was happening with the protests against the war and the changes in the university curriculum and student life policies.
Kurt Ellison is Emeritus Professor of History and American Studies at Miami University. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.